File 10. No adverts from audiobooksforfree.com.
There was an agitated knock at the door, and an instant afterwards Dr. Huxtable was in the room. In his hand he held a blue cricket cap with a white chevron on the peak.
"At last we have a clue," he cried. "Thank heaven! At last we are on the dear boy's track. It is his cap."
"Where was it found?"
"In the van of the gypsies who camped on the moor. They left on Tuesday. Today the police traced them down and examined their caravan. This was found."
"How do they account for it?"
"They shuffled and lied. Said that they found it on the moor on Tuesday morning. They know where he is, the rascals. Thank goodness they are all safe under lock and key. Either the fear of the law or the Duke's purse will certainly get out of them all that they know."
"So far, so good," said Holmes, when the doctor had at last left the room. "It at least bears out the theory that it is on the side of the Lower Gill Moor that we must hope for results. The police have really done nothing locally, save the arrest of these gypsies.
Look here, Watson, there is a watercourse across the moor. You see it marked here in the map. In some parts it widens into a morass. This is particularly so in the region between Holderness Hall and the school. It is vain to look elsewhere for tracks in this dry weather, but at that point there is certainly a chance of some record being left. I will call you early tomorrow morning, and you and I will try if we can throw some little light upon the mystery."
The day was just breaking when I woke to find the long, thin form of Holmes by my bedside. He was fully dressed, and had apparently already been out.
"I've done the lawn and the bicycle shed," said he.
"I have also had a ramble through the ragged shore. Now, Watson, there is cocoa ready in the next room. I must beg you to hurry, for we have a great day before us." His eyes shone, and his cheek was flushed with the exhilaration of the master workman who sees his work lie ready before him. A very different Holmes, this active, alert man, from the introspective and pallid dreamer of Baker Street. I felt, as I looked upon that supple figure, alive with nervous energy, that it was indeed a strenuous day that awaited us. And yet it opened in the blackest disappointment. With high hopes we struck across the peaty, russet moor, intersected with a thousand sheep paths, until we came to the broad, light-green belt which marked the morass between us and Holderness. Certainly, if the lad had gone homeward, he must have passed this, and he could not pass it without leaving his traces. But no sign of him or the German could be seen. With a darkening face, my friend strode along the margin, eagerly observant of every muddy stain upon the mossy surface. Sheep marks there were in profusion, and at one place, some miles down, cows had left their tracks. Nothing more.
"Check number one," said Holmes, looking gloomily over the rolling expanse of the moor. "There is another morass down yonder, and a narrow neck between."
"Hello, hello, hello, what have we here?" We had come on a small black ribbon of pathway. In the middle of it, clearly marked on the sodden soil, was the track of a bicycle.
"Hurrah!" I cried. "We have it!"
But Holmes was shaking his head, and his face was puzzled and expectant rather than joyous.
"A bicycle, certainly, but not the bicycle," said he. "I am familiar with 42 different impressions left by tyres. This, as you perceive, is a Dunlop with a patch upon the outer cover. Heidegger's tyres were Palmer's, leaving longitudinal stripes. Aveling, the mathematical master, was sure upon the point. Therefore, it is not Heidegger's track."
"The boy's, then?"
"Possibly, if we could prove a bicycle to have been in his possession. But this we have utterly failed to do. This track, as you perceive, was made by a rider who was going from the direction of the school."
"Or towards it?"
"No, no, my dear Watson. The more deeply sunk impression is, of course, the hind wheel upon which the weight rests. You perceive several places where it has passed across and obliterated the more shallow mark of the front one. It was undoubtedly heading away from the school. It may or may not be connected with our inquiry, but we will follow it backwards before we go any farther."
We did so, and at the end of a few hundred yards lost the tracks as we emerged from the boggy portion of the moor. Following the path backwards, we picked out another spot where a spring trickled across it. Here once again was the mark of the bicycle, though nearly obliterated by the hooves of cows. After that there was no sign, but the path ran right on into ragged shore, the wood which backed on to the school. From this wood the cycle must have emerged. Holmes sat down on a boulder and rested his chin in his hands.
I had smoked 2 cigarettes before he moved. "Well, well," said he at last, "it is of course possible that a cunning man might change the tires of his bicycle in order to leave unfamiliar tracks. A criminal who is capable of such a thought is a man whom I should be proud to do business with. We will leave this question undecided and hark back to our morass again, for we have left a good deal unexplored." We continued our systematic survey of the edge of the sodden portion of the moor, and soon our perseverance was gloriously rewarded. Right across the lower part of the bog lay a miry path. Holmes gave a cry of delight as he approached it. An impression like a fine bundle of telegraph wires ran down the centre of it. It was the Palmer tires. "Here is Herr Heidegger, sure enough," cried Holmes exultantly. "My reasoning seems to have been pretty sound, Watson."
"I congratulate you.
But we have a long way still to go. Kindly walk clear of the path. Now let us follow the trail. I fear that it will not lead very far." We found, however, as we advanced, that this portion of the moor is intersected with soft patches, and though we frequently lost sight of the track, we always succeeded in picking it up once more. "Do you observe," said Holmes, "that the rider is now undoubtedly forcing the pace? There can be no doubt of it. Look at this impression, where you get both tires clear. The one is as deep as the other. That can only mean that the rider is throwing his weight onto the handlebar, as a man does when he is sprinting. By Jove! He has had a fall." There was a broad, irregular smudge covering some yards of the track. Then there were a few footmarks, and the tyres reappeared once more. "A side slip," I suggested. Holmes held up a crumpled branch of flowering gorse. To my horror, I perceived that the yellow blossoms were all dabbled with crimson. On the path, too, and among the heather, were dark stains of clotted blood. "Bad," said Holmes. "Bad. Stand clear, Watson. Not an unnecessary footstep. What do I read here? He fell wounded, he stood up, he remounted, he proceeded. But there is no other track. Cattle on this side path. He was surely not gored by a bull. Impossible. But I see no traces of anyone else. We must push on, Watson, surely with stains as well as the track to guide us. He cannot escape us now." Our search was not a very long one. The tracks of the tyre began to curve fantastically upon the wet and shining path. Suddenly, as I looked ahead, a gleam of metal caught my eye from amid the thick gorse bushes. Out of them we dragged a bicycle, Palmer tyred, one pedal bent, and the whole front of it horribly smeared and slobbered with blood. On the other side of the bushes a shoe was projecting. We ran round, and there lay the unfortunate rider. He was a tall man, full-bearded, with spectacles, one glass of which had been knocked out. The cause of his death was a frightful blow upon the head which had crushed in part of his skull. That he could have gone on after receiving such an injury said much for the vitality and courage of the man. He wore shoes but no socks, and his open coat disclosed a nightshirt beneath it. It was undoubtedly the German master. Holmes turned the body over reverently and examined it with great attention. He then sat in deep thought for a time, and I could see by his ruffled brow that this grim discovery had not, in his opinion, advanced us much in our inquiry. "It is a little difficult to know what to do, Watson," said he at last. "My own inclinations are to push this inquiry on, for we have already lost so much time that we cannot afford to waste another hour. On the other hand, we are bound to inform the police of the discovery and to see that this poor fellow's body is looked after."
"I could take a note back,
but I need your company and assistance. Wait a bit. There is a fellow cutting peat up yonder. Bring him over here, and he will guide the police." I brought the peasant across, and Holmes dispatched the frightened man with a note to Dr. Huxtable. "Now, Watson," said he, "we have picked up 2 clues this morning. One is the bicycle with the Palmer tyre, and we see what that has led to. The other is the bicycle with a patched Dunlop. Before we start to investigate that, let us try to realize what we do know, so as to make the most of it, and to separate the essential from the accidental. First of all, I wish to impress upon you that the boy certainly left of his own free will. He got down from his window, and he went off, either alone or with someone. That is sure."
I assented.
"Well, now, let us turn to this unfortunate German master. The boy was fully dressed when he fled, therefore he foresaw what he would do. But the German went without his socks. He certainly acted on very short notice.
Undoubtedly.
Why did he go? Because, from his bedroom window, he saw the flight of the boy. Because he wished to overtake him and bring him back. He seized his bicycle, pursued the lad, and in pursuing him, met his death.
So it would seem.
Now, I come to the critical part of my argument. The natural action of a man in pursuing a little boy would be to run after him. He would know that he could overtake him. But the German does not do so. He turns to his bicycle. I am told that he was an excellent cyclist. He would not do this if he did not see that the boy had some swift means of escape.
The other bicycle.
Let us continue our reconstruction. He meets his death 5 miles from the school, not by a bullet, mark you, which even a lad might conceivably discharge, but by a savage blow dealt by a vigorous arm. The lad, then, had a companion in his flight. And the flight was a swift one, since it took 5 miles before an expert cyclist could overtake them. Yet we survey the ground round the scene of the tragedy. What do we find? A few cattle tracks, nothing more. I took a wide sweep round, and there is no path within 50 yards. Another cyclist could have had nothing to do with the actual murder, nor were there any human footmarks.
Holmes, I cried, this is impossible.
Admirable, he said. A most illuminating remark. It is impossible, as I stated, and therefore I must in some respect have stated it wrong. Yet you saw for yourself. Can you suggest any fallacy?
He could not have fractured his skull in a fall.
In a morass, Watson?
I am at my wit's end.
Tut, tut, we have solved some worse problems. At least we have plenty of material if we can only use it. Come then, and having exhausted the palmer, let us see what the Dunlop with the patched cover has to offer us.
We picked up the track and followed it onward for some distance, but soon the moor rose into a long, heather-tufted curve, and we left the watercourse behind us. No further help from tracks could be hoped for. At the spot where we saw the last of the Dunlop tire, it might equally have led to Holderness Hall, the stately towers of which rose some miles to our left, or to a low, grey village which lay in front of us and marked the position of the Chesterfield High Road. As we approached the forbidding and squalid inn, with the sign of a gamecock above the door, Holmes gave a sudden groan and clutched me by the shoulder to save himself from falling. He had had one of those violent strains of the ankle which leave a man helpless. With difficulty he limped up to the door, where a squat, dark, elderly man was smoking a black clay pipe.
"How are you, Mr. Reuben Hayes?"
said Holmes. "Who are you? And how'd you get my name so pat?"
the countryman answered with a suspicious flash of a pair of cunning eyes.
"Well, it's printed on the board above your head. It's easy to see a man who is master of his own house. I suppose you haven't such a thing as a carriage in your stables?"
"No, I have not."
"I can hardly put my foot to the ground."
"Don't put it to the ground."
"But I can't walk."
"Well, then, hop."
Mr. Reuben Hayes's manner was far from gracious, but Holmes took it with admirable good humour.
"Look here, my man,"
said he.
"This is really rather an awkward fix for me. I don't mind how I get on."
"Neither do I," said the morose landlord.
"The matter is very important. I would offer you a sovereign for the use of a bicycle."
The landlord pricked up his ears.
"Where do you want to go?"
"To Holderness Hall."
"Pals of the Duke, I suppose,"
said the landlord, surveying our mud-stained garments with ironical eyes. Holmes laughed good-naturedly.
"He'll be glad to see us, anyhow."
"Why?"
"Because we bring him news of his lost son."
The landlord gave a very visible start.
"What? You're on his track?"
"He has been heard of in Liverpool. They expect to get him every hour."
Again the swift change passed over the heavy, unshaven face. His manner was suddenly genial.
"I've less reason to wish the Duke well than most men," said he. "For I was his head coachman once, and cruel bad he treated me. It was him that sacked me without a character on the word of a lying corn chandler. But I'm glad to hear that the young lord was heard of in Liverpool, and I hope you take the news to the hall."
"Thank you,"
said Holmes.
"We'll have some food first, then you can bring round the bicycle."
"I haven't got a bicycle."
Holmes held up a sovereign.
"I tell you, man, that I haven't got one. I'll let you have 2 horses as far as the hall."
"Well, well,"
said Holmes.
"We'll talk about it when we've had something to eat."
When we were left alone in the stone-flagged kitchen, it was astonishing how rapidly that sprained ankle recovered. It was nearly nightfall, and we had eaten nothing since early morning, so that we spent some time over our meal. Holmes was lost in thought, and once or twice he walked over to the window and stared earnestly out. It opened onto a squalid courtyard. In the far corner was a smithy where a grimy lad was at work. On the other side were the stables. Holmes had sat down again after one of these excursions when he suddenly sprang out of his chair with a loud exclamation.
"By heavens, Watson! I believe that I've got it!" he cried. "Yes, yes, it must be so. Watson, do you remember seeing any cow tracks today?"
"Yes, several."
"Where?"
"Well, everywhere. They were at the morass, and again on the path, and again near where poor Heidegger met his death."
"Exactly. Well now, Watson, how many cows did you see on the moor?"
"I don't remember seeing any."
"Strange, Watson, that we should see tracks all along our line, but never a cow on the whole moor. Very strange, Watson, eh?"
"Yes, it is strange."
"Now, Watson, make an effort. Throw your mind back. Can you see those tracks upon the path?"
"Yes, I can."
"Can you recall that the tracks were sometimes like that, Watson?"
He arranged a number of breadcrumbs in a series of parallel dots placed horizontally, one above the other.
"And sometimes like this."
"Then with each alternate upper dot missing."
"And occasionally like this."
"Then with the dots alternating above and below."
"Can you remember that?"
"No, I cannot."
"But I can. I could swear to it. However, we will go back at our leisure and verify it. What a blind beetle I have been not to draw my conclusion."
"And what is your conclusion?"
"Only that it is a remarkable cow which walks, canters, and gallops." "By George, Watson, it was no brain of a country publican that thought out such a blind as that. The coast seems to be clear, save for that lad in the smithy. Let us slip out and see what we can see."
There were two rough-haired, unkempt horses in the tumble-down stable. Holmes raised the hind leg of one of them and laughed aloud.
"Old shoes, but newly shod. Old shoes, but new nails. This case deserves to be a classic. Let us go across to the smithy."
The lad continued his work without regarding us. I saw Holmes's eye darting to right and left among the litter of iron and wood which was scattered about the floor. Suddenly, however, we heard a step behind us, and there was the landlord, his heavy eyebrows drawn over his savage eyes, his swarthy features convulsed with passion. He held a short metal-headed stick in his hand, and he advanced in so menacing a fashion that I was right glad to feel the revolver in my pocket.
"You infernal spies!"
the man cried.
"What are you doing there?"
"Why, Mr. Reuben Hayes," said Holmes coolly, "one might think that you were afraid of our finding something out."
The man mastered himself with a violent effort, and his grim mouth loosened into a false laugh, which was more menacing than his frown.
"You're welcome to all that you can find out in my smithy," said he. "But look here, mister, I don't care for folk poking about my place without me leave, so the sooner you pay your score and get out of this, the better I shall be pleased."
"All right, Mr. Hayes, no harm meant," said Holmes. "We have been having a look at your horses, but I think I'll walk, after all. It's not far, I believe."
"Not more than 2 miles to the hall gates. That's the road to the left."
He watched us with sullen eyes until we had left his premises. We did not go very far along the road, for Holmes stopped the instant that the curve hid us from the landlord's view.
"We were warm, as the children say, at that inn," said he. "I seem to grow colder every step that I take away from it. No, no, I can't possibly leave it."
"I'm convinced," said I, "that this Reuben Hayes knows all about it. A more self-evident villain I never saw."
"Oh, he impressed you in that way, did he? There are the horses, there is the smithy. Yes, it is an interesting place, this fighting cock. I think we shall have another look at it in an unobtrusive way."
A long, sloping hillside, dotted with grey limestone boulders, stretched behind us. We had turned off the road and were making our way up the hill when, looking in the direction of Holderness Hall, I saw a cyclist coming swiftly along.
"Get down, Watson!"
cried Holmes with a heavy hand upon my shoulder. We had hardly sunk from view when the man flew past us on the road.
Amid a rolling cloud of dust, I caught a glimpse of a pale, agitated face, a face with horror in every lineament, the mouth open, the eyes staring wildly in front. It was like some strange caricature of the dapper James Wilder whom we had seen the night before. "The Duke's secretary!" cried Holmes. "Come, Watson, let us see what he does." We scrambled from rock to rock until in a few moments we had made our way to a point from which we could see the front door of the inn. Wilder's bicycle was leaning against the wall beside it. No one was moving about the house, nor could we catch a glimpse of any faces at the windows. Slowly the twilight crept down as the sun sank behind the high towers of Holderness Hall. Then, in the gloom, we saw the two side lamps of a trap light up in the stable-yard of the inn, and shortly afterwards heard the rattle of hooves as it wheeled out into the road and tore off at a furious pace in the direction of Chesterfield.
"What do you make of that, Watson?"
Holmes whispered.
"It looks like a flight. A single man in a dog-cart, so far as I could see. Well, it certainly was not Mr. James Wilder, for there he is at the door.